On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Today, a conversation with the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools about a range of issues affecting the 85,000 students in one of the country's largest school districts. We'll talk about school violence and school policing strategies, progress on the goals in the school's new strategic plan, the status of the $2 billion school construction initiative, and the dismal results as students took for the first time a test called Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. Dr. Gregory Thornton joins me. We'll assess his first 18 months on the job. Plus, be honest, does this show make me look fat? The nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, on whether or not our idea of what overweight is has evolved over the last 30 years. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan has the local news. Dr. Gregory Thornton joins me right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. My guest this morning is Dr. Gregory Thornton, who was appointed CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools a year and a half ago. The city's roughly 85,000 students and more than 5,000 teachers face huge challenges. Recent test scores indicate that many city students, particularly those who live in our poorest neighborhoods, must make extraordinary gains in future tests if they are to catch up with students in nearby counties and around the country. Violence in schools, like the violence that often surrounds students where they live, remains an implacable problem. Over the last 6 years, the rate of Baltimore City students who attend college has fallen below 50%, and most of the students who do attend college attend a two-year college instead of a four-year program. Recently, the school system released a five-year strategic plan which addresses these and other issues. Dr. Gregory Thornton joins me in the studio. Good morning, sir, and happy holidays.
Oh, happy holidays. Great to be with you today.
Thanks for your time. So let's talk about this issue of school violence. We live in a violent city, 336 homicides, the highest per capita homicide rate that we've ever had. Many of our students live in the neighborhoods that are so deeply affected. Just on Sunday, Ananias Jolly died after injuries he received in a stabbing at Renaissance Academy on the 24th of November. Policing in schools, yeah. The policy has changed since last April. There are no longer police officers in most schools.
Correct.
They're now just in seven different schools.
Correct.
Renaissance Academy, not one of them. There was a change in the policy. Now the police are around the schools. They're outside, but they're not inside the building. We spend about $8.5 million on policing in schools. Is that policy something you're going to take another look at?
Oh, we're taking a very deep look, but you're absolutely right. The challenges that our young people face each day in our communities is devastating. We're up to 21 juvenile homicides this year, with about 38, 39 shootings on top of that. But unfortunately, what you're seeing is a microcosm of our community and the communities in which many of our young people live. Our young people are resilient, and they still come to school. Attendance is at 90%. Last year, we made a significant change in how we support children in the schoolhouse. It was a result, really, of really becoming in line with the present regulations and law. And as a result of that, I actually had to pull out all my armed officers and actually put them on a community policing detail, which has been highly effective. We have not seen a tremendous change in suspensions. And what we have seen is a tremendous drop in arrest. One of the things that's always concerned me in public education is the whole issue around school, that pipeline from certainly school to prison. And I'm really pleased to say, as I begin to look at the numbers and unpack the numbers, we're really utilizing a number of strategies that we haven't used in the past that I think certainly positions young people for success.
Are you restricted by city law in terms of officers carrying weapons inside the school building?
I certainly am. And as a result of that, apparently, it's been going on for a number of years. And I think one day someone stopped me and said, "Do you realize you're breaking the law?" I said, "Breaking what law?" "Well, police have weapons in schools." And you know, I just passed it by, you know. Many people
but
tell me
But you advocated that law be changed.
I certainly did. I mean, we're the only LEA in the entire state of Maryland that does not allow their officers to have weapons in school. And I would suggest that Baltimore is a place where we could certainly
And that's a matter for the city council or a matter for the state
it's
legislature?
It's a state legislature issue. And as a result of that, after we actually positioned ourselves to have that conversation in Annapolis last year, we went around the city and we held meeting after meeting. And the community's mixed, whether this is a appropriate utilization of our police force inside the buildings. Our force is just like Chief Davis's force. They all have the same training. They're all equipped to certainly to utilize the appropriate strategies. And one thing we've really doubled down
on. So it's not a matter of money then?
It's not a matter of money at all.
$8.5 million seems to be sufficient, right?
It's very sufficient. And hopefully as we continue to move forward, as behavior continues, I think, to certainly improve, I'm going to be able to reduce that. I would love to put that money in certainly support services, guidance counselors, social workers, and things of that nature, because I believe that's the root of the issue that many of our young people face.
But in the short term, without a law being changed that doesn't allow officers to carry weapons, you think carrying weapons is probably the way to keep the students safest. But in the short term, if that's not going to be possible, what can we do to improve violence? I mean, the kids are getting stabbed to death at school.
Youngster has been stabbed, and that's the first probably on my watch, and I've been doing this for 38 years. The challenge we have right now is certainly positioning our people in the right places at the right times. So I have seven schools in which I have officers in. However, they're not armed. Mm-hmm. And so as we begin to take a look going into next school year, we'll have before the board a new proposal looking at ways in which we can certainly support our youngsters.
Dr. Gregory Thornton is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Thornton, when you were appointed in February 2014, you listed three goals: raising student achievement, overseeing the renovations plan for the city school buildings, and strengthening relations with the greater community. These are basically the three pillars of a strategic plan that you just released a couple weeks ago. We've got, you know, PARC tests, these PARCC test scores that are, you know, very disappointing. We've got only 25 schools underway instead of the 45 schools that were originally planned to be built or renovated. I mean, that number has gone down considerably from the original estimates. We've got these school policing issues and stuff.
Sure.
I mean, how you doing on those priorities?
Let's take one at a time. Let's take the school construction plan. Well underway. We're right where we should be. When we came in, we recalibrated. We took a look at cost at that particular point in time. I think it was a really robust effort to certainly try to have as many new facilities. Our children need new facilities. When we began to take a look at the facilities that we did have, they were certainly not prepared to actually deliver a 21st century education. So we're right where we need to be with respect. And we're really proud of the efforts, strong partnership with the city, strong partnership with the Maryland Stadium Authority. We're putting shovels in the ground as we speak.
So the legislation was passed in 2013. How
Correct.
Many projects are underway right now, 2 years later?
Probably underway from conceptual drawings to architects, probably right around 12 or 14.
Mm-hmm. And am I right in knowing that the estimate for the original number of schools you're going to be able to build and renovate is down from 45 to 25, that they just found that the budget numbers didn't add up?
The numbers just didn't add up, and the cost certainly is a major factor in that. You know, we all had, I think, really great hopes actually to reinvent our school portfolio. We need it. I mean, we have schools that we can't use the water. I mean, we
right.
actually bring in water. I mean, some of our schools have not had the maintenance support that they should have had over the years. So as we begin to recalibrate, we're very optimistic as we move forward that we're going to be able to move from the 25. You know, we put a range out from 23 to 28 to get as close as we can to get more facilities. Our facilities are challenged, probably the most challenged in the entire state of
Maryland.
But
we're nowhere close to the 45.
You know, we're close at this particular point to the 45. I mean, hopefully, I'm really optimistic that as we do a great job with round one, we'll be able to go back to the legislature and say, hey, look, this is where we are, and this is what we can do.
So a year and a half into your tenure here, I know you've been working hard. Do you feel that you enjoy the support of the mayor? Do you feel you enjoy the support of the board of the school board?
I take a look at the school board, and you look at the resolutions that I put forward, and I think I'm batting probably 990, with respect to approval for what we've been able to move forward. And the mayor and I share a really positive relationship. We're in constant conversation with each other, trying to work together as a partner. At the end of the today. I'm of the belief if we're going to transform this city, it's going to be on the backs of education. So I think it's incumbent upon us to continue to have those relationships.
Well, the reason I asked her is that I've been hearing that you're currently negotiating a severance package to leave the school system.
Well, I can tell you today there's not a severance package on the table that's being negotiated. I came to Baltimore because I wanted to be in Baltimore. It's close to my home. Baltimore is now my new home. And as we continue to move forward, I don't know who you're talking to, but they haven't talked to me, and mm-hmm. No one's suggested I leave, or no one's asked for me to leave, or and yeah, I came off my first year evaluation. It was pretty positive, so I'm kind of encouraged.
All right, so I mean, this is more than one person, and so there's no plans for you to leave the school system.
Not at this point in time.
And you're not involved in discussions about that?
Not involved in discussions.
Okay, so we're not going to hear anything after the first
year. I can't tell you what you're going to hear because I don't know who was talking to you to start with. But at the end of the day, they haven't been talking to me. I think that's a conversation probably should include me if something like that's on the table.
One would think.
Yeah, one would think.
The legislative priorities as the session begins next month. What's on the top of your list?
One big issue for us is around early childhood education. What we found out last year when we actually received the results back, that our kids can compete with any youngster in this entire state. Our work around kindergarten readiness is exemplary. I think it really sets a strong foundation of really building a strong educational program. When we look at the PARC results, it basically begins to speak of the fact that many
those
of
tests we were talking about
those
before.
PARC mm-hmm. tests, it's a state assessment actually used in 12 states around the country. It's not a national exam. It's the thinking once would that we would have the same exam so we could actually do comparisons from state to state. But basically, a strong readiness is I think makes a great finish. So the work that we're doing at early childhood is what we want to expand. That's what we will go to the legislature with a really proven track record that we can get this done.
Is it a matter of money? The Fordham Institute issued a report that said the Baltimore City Public Schools spends about $17,300 per student. That's $5,000 more per student than the national average. I mean, is there just a deficit and a paucity of funding for the schools? Is that at the root of all of the challenges you face?
If you ask any probably superintendent or a CEO around the country, they would say money is a challenge. It's a challenge here. I mean, costs are a major challenge for us as we continue certainly to move forward. And we have some cost drivers that are hard to get our arms around. But as a result, they strip dollars from classrooms. And at the end of the day, if we're going to make a difference in the lives of kids, the money has to be in classrooms. The $17,000, I would certainly debate for them with respect to what that number looks like. You know, at the end of the day, I think one way of addressing it and what I've attempted to address it is basically looking at efficiencies, organizational efficiencies in which I can lower my costs so I can certainly bring more dollars. You know, we've done a lot of work. I think with respect to our reorganization of central office, we had the first layoff that we've had in a number of years. We are having really good conversation with our union partners. How do we contain healthcare? Healthcare is a major challenge around America. We've looked at every aspect of the school district, from transportation, certainly the building costs. Those are the kinds of things that I think, coupled with more resources, create a better return on the investment for children.
If you're just joining us, my guest this morning is Dr. Gregory Thornton, the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. He took over the school system, one of the largest in the country, in July of 2014. Earlier in the show, Dr. Thornton said that speculation about his leaving the school system is unfounded. We also talked about policy changes that occurred last spring around school policing and his priorities for the upcoming session of the Maryland legislature. What would you say, Dr. Thornton, is the biggest difference, or are there differences and departures from some of the policies and some of the initiatives that your predecessor, Dr. Andres Alonzo, put in place?
Give me an example.
For example, Dr. Alonzo came to Baltimore focusing on school-based autonomy.
Correct.
Thinking that, especially in terms of the budgeting process, that was important.
Sure.
And I understand that your model is more of what they refer to as a tiered autonomy. So what's the difference there, and how big a departure is that, and why?
I think there isn't one right way for any individual school district. As I've been able to come in and certainly have really strong conversations, the budget actually drives everything. And at the end of the day, one of the challenges we have is due to the big turnover of principals. I mean, we've had 100 principal changes in the last 5 years, which is dramatic. I turn over anywhere between 600 and 700 teachers a year, which is a major challenge for some of the conversations that we've had earlier with respect to student success, is that all schools aren't created equal. I have some of the best schools that you would find in the entire state of Maryland, and certainly could be competitive all over. Then I have some schools that are very, very challenged. We talked about it with respect to the PARC structure. In reality, reality is that if you're going to have a standard of care in our schools, and what I mean by a standard of care is that every school has a rich learning environment, sometimes you have to certainly insist that those things happen, and sometimes you have to create the conditions for those who have the know-how to get that work done, have the experience to get that work done. They certainly are entitled, I think, to have that balanced autonomy that my predecessor basically talked about. But then there are schools, as I mentioned, where you have 100 principal changes, and they're just not there. You have to train up to it. And as we begin to move forward, our model is basically looking along a continuum and placing schools where they have earned that autonomy, so that they can make the decisions. I had one principal say to me, Doc, the autonomy was great. They gave me $14 million in a budget, and I have a school budget, and I have trouble balancing my own checkbook. Well, that's not a person that I want basically managing boundless autonomy. But I think the structure is one that it creates a space and room for really some great thinkers, and we have some folks who maximize and squeeze every single dollar. They utilize outside resources. And then there are folks that I got to ensure that there's a standard of care.
So the goal then is to move towards back towards more autonomy once these principals
earned,
get up to
but
speed.
But earned autonomy. Mm-hmm. You don't walk in the door and I give you the keys and give you a check and says, here's $10 million, go at it. No, I want to be certain that you can demonstrate the utilization and I get the return on the investment for children.
And retention not only of principals but of teachers is an issue then.
It's a major issue.
Because we're investing a lot of money training some of these young teachers. And
not enough.
They're leaving the profession.
Truly not. We're spending a lot, but they're leaving the profession. And when you turn over 700 teachers, think about that. That's probably more teachers in several school districts than the entire state has, totally. You take 100 principals. That's a big change in five years.
So what can we do to keep them?
Well, I think with the retention strategies we're doing are certainly in place. Really doing a really deep dive and doing a better job in recruiting the right people, being certain that this is a great match. Urban education is not for everybody. I mean, it's for folks who have a deep mission, a deep commitment around trying to take folks from poverty to a place where they know that they can go. It's, you know, our children here bring a lot of baggage to the school. And in those bags, they have some challenges, family challenges. They have homeless challenges. They have boundless challenges. That's not the work for every administrator in public education. Some folks take schools from good to great, and some of our folks take our youngsters where they are and then make them great. You know, mm-hmm. So
on the one hand, there are places where there's a bigger role, it seems to me, for the central administration in things like, for example, early childhood education.
Correct.
You mentioned before, you know, a reading curriculum. Is
correct.
There, for example, an in-place reading curriculum to get kids reading? Because we've got enormous numbers of young kids, first, second, third graders, who are not reading at proficiency at the level they should be at. There are some folks who would say that's an instance where you need to be giving teachers lesson plans. On the other hand, you want autonomy in other areas. How do you balance
that? I would say you're partially right. The creativity that I see in some classrooms are exciting. When I came in, it's the first place you look when you come to a district and you take a look at the curriculum. And actually, I launched a curriculum audit. And in that audit, I had a group of experts coming from the outside to take a look at the curriculum. Are we teaching the right stuff? Is this the stuff that's going? Is this the materials that are going to take us to where we need to go? And they did the audit, and they took a look at a couple of things. They took a look at the curriculum. And they gave me really high marks on it. Golly, this is the curriculum. This is it. This will take you where you need to be. Where I fell short, where we fall short as an organization, is certainly around the pedagogy and how we deliver it.
We need more of a concentration on instruction.
On instruction. It's the pedagogy that actually will drive it, and being able to differentiate and using multi-tiered systems to actually differentiate. You know, you may learn a little faster than me, or I may learn a little faster. How do I create the conditions in our classroom that basically supports that? Curriculum, tight. Pedagogy is a major challenge for us, and I think part of the challenge is just due to the big turnover that we have. That has to stop.
One recommendation you got was to spend about $7 million putting reading specialists, for example, in many schools, if not all schools. Do we come back to a matter of money and a matter of allocation
of resources?
It comes back to a matter of money,
but also comes back to a theory of action around tiered autonomy. In some schools, I don't need them. Goes back to the tiered autonomy where some schools are really doing really great jobs, and then there's some schools I may need two or three of them. Mm-hmm. Each one of our youngsters brings something different. They all bring gifts to school, but some of them don't bring the gifts of having the fundamental skills of knowing their colors, knowing how to read from left to right, having a good sight word vocabulary and things of that nature. Those are the things, and those are the schools need more. Want to differentiate based on the needs of kids, not a model that says we're going back to, as you said, everybody has to same curriculum. Everybody's going to be on the same page. Everybody's going to get the same test. We went to school. We took tests on Friday. I don't know about you. I mean, everybody's going to get the test on Friday. It's not like that anymore. I got to have a dynamic educational program that allows kids to be involved. And when you learn something, you move on to something else, and you're constantly spiraling back to be certain that you retain what you've learned.
Dr. Gregory Thornton is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning here on 88.1 WYPR. Of course, understanding, Dr. Thornton, whether or not the kids are doing well or not, we use vehicles like this PARC test, the PARCC test. Here's a clip from a woman who teaches at Digital Harbor High School about testing and about this notion of how much time people are spending testing versus in the classroom.
Our scores and our data are not valuable to teachers. They're not valuable to communities. We're spending millions of dollars and we're wasting a lot of class time. We can't use our library. We can't use our computer labs. We can't give our students what they need. And every time I ask about it, I do not get an answer that is clear or satisfactory.
This goes back to this emphasis on instruction versus, you know, assessment. What's your response to this young woman?
I think I recognize the voice. I do a lot of community meetings. There are three levels of testing. One, there is a test that we participate in, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a test we do every 2 years to see how Baltimore is stacking up across the country. Then there's the PARC test, which you certainly have referenced. It's a state exam.
And by the way, it's the Partnership for Assessments of Career and College Readiness.
Correct. That's actually gone, we utilize, and it's actually been part of the new Elementary Secondary Education Act moving forward. And then there's certainly formative. I think she might be right.
And by formative, you mean what?
Formative is a test where I would give you a test to find out what you know, and then I would turn around and certainly try to support you with strategies in the classroom to be certain that you have that skill and can certainly utilize it. So those are three types. I think she's absolutely right. We overtest. As a result of that, I took some away this year. I took some of the unit tests away. A couple of them I can't take away. There's no option around PARC. I mean, PARC is here, and PARC is here to stay. If not PARC, something else will substitute.
What explains the dismal results of these tests?
I will tell you, I wasn't surprised. I mean, after taking a look at the curriculum audit, after looking at our first round of a formative exam, I saw that there were tremendous challenges, and I would also say that they were consistent with the National Educational Assessment of Progress. And I think it's around preparation. I think the fact that many of our young people don't come as prepared as we would like for them. And I think we owe them a better job, better opportunities in classrooms. I think I spoke to it earlier that we have to certainly be prepared to actually do a better job getting our teachers trained and supported to be able to differentiate and meet kids where they are and take them to new places.
This sounds, I hear you, but this sounds like a fundamental, you know, indictment of what we've been doing so far.
Well,
I mean, these kids really did terribly on these tests.
It was a baseline. I mean, it was a start of where we were, where we are right now. I will say that, you know, when I looked at the eighth grade scores, and, you know, it was very sobering to me. I mean, kids have been in the system for the last 9 years, starting in kindergarten. And when you only have a handful of kids that are meeting expectations, it's an indictment on us as an organization.
And our test scores have been falling over the last couple of years.
They've been statistically flat. I mean, and when you say falling, you're going, you know, from 5% to 4% is statistically flat.
For example, the TUDA test, which is this trial urban district assessment.
Right.
We had them in Milwaukee as well.
Correct.
So where school systems, urban school systems agree to be part of, you know, this consortium.
Which
that
is
compares,
optional.
You know, which is optional.
That's an optional test.
Right. We used to be in the lowest 40%. Now we're even lower in places like eighth grade math. I mean, it's going down. Is there a short-term strategy to get this fixed by the next time? Are we going to be in this situation the same time next year?
Well, statistically, we're going to improve. I have a lot of confidence, and I think that improvement is really predicated on the work we're going to be able to support, the way we're going to support our teachers and creating ways. Now they have a document in hand. They have a formative assessment that says what kids are not doing well, so they can actually move forward. So that was a really great piece. So when you begin to look at that exam, which people, you know, would probably suggest that's just one more test we could get rid of, I like the test. In Milwaukee, basically, there was a big push, same conversations, a national conversation around over-assessment. We passed it, and we went to really looking at just the state exam and looking at formative. So now we know exactly where our kids are experiencing problems, and we can certainly teach that, and we certainly can create our curriculum to actually support that. So I think the strategy is going to be right on target. We're looking at extended learning opportunities for youngsters in the summer. There's a number of people in this community that are ready to stand in. But for many years, we've basically been working very hard and not going very far, like being on a treadmill. So now we have a focused way in which we can certainly support our young people in a differentiated way to provide them the supports that they need. Technology will play a big part. I mean, at the end of the day, one of the big things will be in this year's budget, big expenditures, is really a way in which we can begin to look at a platform where our kids can have personalized and customized learning. Those are the strategies that I think will get us there. We know what we need to teach, know how to teach it. Now we need to get it done.
So here's a gentleman also from Digital Harbor High School, another member of the faculty, talking about a test that we purchased.
iReady.
iReady.
Oh, yeah.
With respect to the iReady testing, much of the data I feel is not 100% accurate because the students are so over-tested and they're so overwhelmed with HSA testing, with finals and midterms, and now these iReady formative assessments that they zoom through these tests. And the test even has a structure in place where it flags them as a yellow flag or a red flag to show that they've completed an hour or a 90-minute test in 20 to 30 minutes. They're just clicking buttons to complete the task, and they're being taken out of class, and we're not getting back valuable input for many of our students.
So are you confident that the data you're getting is data that's real and that you can use?
Certainly in the administration, it would be a concern that the gentleman speaks of. I think I've spoken with this gentleman as well. But I will tell you that there's a high correlation between youngsters' results in iReady and certainly the standardized tests that we want to certainly see significant gains. And that's the roadmap. The formatives are the roadmap. That's one that we will not let go. Certainly we can have conversations around the NAEP results and future administration of NAEP.
It's NAPE. That's a different, a whole
that's,
other
that's,
difference.
That's a national exam. I need to get kids ready for college. I need to get kids ready for the world of work. And based on the results that we've seen, we saw off our formative assessment, there is a consistency between that exam, the NAEP exams, and certainly the work that we've done in PARC. So now that we have triangulation of those three, I think it creates a really strong roadmap to move forward. When you begin to look at testing, you know, I will be the first to say that we kind of went too far in that direction. Now we need to dial it back and only utilize the things that are necessary to help improve
instruction. And you have the prerogative to do some of that dialing back. It's not necessarily that you're, you know, at the behest of national standards or state standards.
We could certainly do it with respect to our national exam. We could certainly could pass on that, but I will say and would have a lot of conversation around. I think that creates a lot of understanding for us, comparatively speaking, because our kids will live all over the world and how they will compete in other places. But the other two are required. One being required by the state and the iReady would be one that's part of our instructional design to figure out what kids know, what are we going to do when they don't know it, and how are we going to support them.
Well, Dr. Thornton, I appreciate it. Thanks so much and best wishes for the holidays. Good to talk to you. We look forward to the next time.
Well, thank you. My best to you. And certainly I will use this opportunity. Certainly our prayers certainly go out to the young man, Mr. Jolly, who passed away a few days ago.
And, well, certainly.
But thank you as well. Love to come back.
All right. We'll have you back in for
bye-bye.
Sure. Dr. Gregory Thornton is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Will have a link to the school system's 5-year strategic plan. It's entitled Excellence and Equity. That's on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up in just a little bit, our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, weighs in on the subject of weighing in.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. As we prepare to sit down for our holiday dinners or graze the buffet at those New Year's Eve parties next week, I thought, well, it's a great stroke of luck that today happens to be Smart Nutrition Day here on Maryland Morning when we check in with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at Nutrition Over Easy and whose weekly podcasts appear on quickanddirtytips.com. Monica has over the years injected all sorts of common sense into our discussion of diet and nutrition. Happy holidays, Monica. How you doing?
I'm here to rain in everyone's holiday parade.
There you go.
Every party needs
a pooper. That's right. Well, I want to ask you about a survey that was published a couple of months ago. This is called the National Health and Nutritional Examination Survey, and it tells us a bit about how the effects of our diet and exercise programs now, or our patterns, you know, what we do, compare to the 1980s. for whatever reason. So the findings, though, are a little disconcerting, to say the least. What did this survey tell us?
Well, this is a survey that's been going on, as you say, for decades. They do it repeatedly, and every few years they'll bring out a new edition of it. And then for the next several years, scientists will parse and slice and dice all that data and see what they can extract from it. So this NHANES is what we call that, is a big source of dietary analysis. And what this analysis found was that if you today were eating a certain amount of calories and getting a certain amount of exercise, that you would weigh 15 to 20 pounds more than you would have if you had been eating that exact same diet and getting that exact same amount of exercise 20 years ago.
So why is that? Is it 20? What's the difference? I mean, a burger's a burger. A fry's right. A fry. If people ran in the 1980s, if they ran a half marathon, you know, they're going to burn basically the same number of calories as if they ran it in 2012. Right?
Exactly.
What's the difference? That makes no sense.
What could possibly explain that? And they suggested a couple of possible explanations for that. There's been a whole series of interesting research projects that have started to identify things that have nothing to do with our diet or our exercise and their impact on how likely we are to gain weight or store fat. Things like not getting enough sleep. Things like being under a lot of stress, emotional stress.
So sleep deprivation, which everybody experiences in some way or another, and the older people get, they probably experience it more. How does that relate? I mean, is it, in other words, do you store more fat or something when you don't have as much sleep?
Right. Well, when you're not getting enough sleep, it changes the level of hormones in your body. Your body perceives that as stress, and stress hormones go up, and we know that those stress hormones tend to promote fat storage in the body. And, you know, not only, you're right, people do sometimes have hard time sleeping as they get older, but everybody seems to get less sleep now than they did, for example, 20 years ago. The average American adult is reporting sleeping only 6 or 7 hours a night. And that's significantly less than what sleep experts tell us we need. And now they're correlating that to weight gain. You know, we're sleeping less, we're gaining weight because of it. That's one possible theory.
And did we sleep more in the 80s? I mean, I, for one, for example, don't remember the 80s. Maybe I just slept through them. I don't know. But I wonder if stuff like technology or something, you know, all
Absolutely.
Of a sudden you get into bed and instead of turning the light off, you grab your phone or your laptop and you're glancing
you're on Netflix,
at Facebook,
right.
Facebook or Netflix or something. I mean, maybe we are really just, you know, we're whiling away the hours with our eyes open instead of our eyes closed.
Absolutely. And the use of those devices right before bed also impairs the quality of the sleep that we get because the frequency of light that they emit affects our brain's ability to kind of shut down and get into good sleep. So there's been a steady decline in sleep quantity and sleep quality for a lot longer than 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's been going on for 50 years or so. But we're all chronically under, and you know, this affects our teenagers too. And that really concerns me because, you know, their brains are still developing and they are among the nation's most sleep deprived.
Right. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, making the school day later because the biorhythms of mm-hmm. teenagers, you know, just are more conducive to starting at 9 or 9:30 in the morning as opposed to some kids who have to start at 7 or 7:30
right. And
on
I
their
think
school day.
Yeah. Those devices should be out of the bedroom after 9 p.m., the phones
yeah.
and the tablets. But anyway, we digress.
Yeah. Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva on 88.1. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Folks also conjecture that we're putting on more weight with the same amount of calories now than we did in the 80s because we're exposed to more chemicals, more pollutants. There's environmental, impact that we just simply didn't have 20 years ago.
Well, there's been some animal research showing that when you expose, for example, lab rats to environmental pollutants, the kinds of things that we're exposed to through plastics and pesticides, that those rats will gain more weight even though they're eating the same diet as people that aren't. That's animal studies, and the exposure levels are usually pretty high. That may be part of it. But I think that these sorts of non-nutritional factors, like how much sleep we're getting, chemicals that we're exposed to, probably don't explain this entire discrepancy. And I actually have a different theory on what might explain it. And that is these studies, the NHANES studies, rely on people's ability to recall and report what they ate yesterday or what they ate over the last month. And I think that there are some reasons that we may not be as good at reporting what we ate even yesterday as we were 20 years ago. It's not that hard to remember what you had for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But now the average person eats somewhere between 8 and 15 times a day. How could you possibly remember and report?
We're just munching all day.
We're eating more. We become a nation of grazers and snackers. We're not containing our meal times to, you know, the three traditional times of day. And I think when you're eating that often throughout the day, your ability to recall all of that accurately is going to be severely impaired. And also, I think we suffer from portion distortion on several different levels. You know, the average portion size and the size of the package that we buy our food in has gotten quite a bit larger over the last 20 years.
Yeah, so if we go to dinner at, you know, TGI Fridays or Applebee's or something, these restaurants are feeling like they have to fill up your plate in a more dramatic way than they did in the 1980s, 30 years ago.
And the plates have gotten bigger, too.
Yeah.
So that's us. But our eyes have adjusted. And so what 20 years ago might have looked like a really large portion might today look like a normal portion. And that's one of the things they ask you on the survey. Okay, so you had spaghetti yesterday. Was it a small, medium, or large size portion? And what we may be reporting now is a medium portion. We might have reported as a large portion 20 years ago. And that discrepancy is not being captured in this data. So I think, yes, there may be some other factors besides what we're eating that are contributing to weight gain, but I don't think that that tells the whole story. And I think that this report might have been a little bit of a red herring.
Yeah, interesting. And on your podcast and blog, you also talked about what our notion of overweight is.
Yeah, you just know,
that has changed in the last 30 years.
Just the way our eyes have adjusted to the sight of larger portions, our eyes have adjusted to the sight of larger bodies. And when we show study subjects pictures of various people and say, which one of these people are normal weight and which one are overweight, people who are overweight are now considered normal by a majority of people. We're used to seeing ourselves, our colleagues, our kids, our spouses, and so we're also not judging body weight the same way. So we really do adjust. We normalize to what.
Yeah, it's interesting. But and of course, in countervailing that is, you know, this notion of how the media glorifies thinness. I mean, the models that you see on magazine covers, you know, have been sometimes airbrushed to look 10 pounds lighter than they already are.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got that too. It's interesting. Our notions of what's pretty and what's beautiful and what's attractive seems to be thinner and thinner and thinner. But our notion of what's normal seems to be much different.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I think we still draw a real line between those figures that we idealize and ourselves.
Interesting. All right. Well, as always, it's fun talking to you. So Merry Christmas. Have a great holiday.
And you as well.
Monica Reinagle, she's the nutrition diva. She stops by Maryland Morning on the third Wednesday of the month for Smart Nutrition. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at Nutrition Over Easy and whose weekly podcasts appear on quickanddirtytips.com. We've got a link to all that on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. On Friday morning, a special Christmas edition of Maryland Morning. We'll share with you some music and some poetry of the season. Until then, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Have a great day.